Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have with me Don Sereau, who is the author of When the Dragon Wore the Crown, Center and Circle, Putting Starlight Back into Myths. Don has a great overview of astrology, astronomy, the connection between the two, and the connection through the ages, and how all the myths worldwide, not just the Greek and Roman mythology, but the myths of the East, the Sumerian myths, and many other myths, the Indian myths, all correlate with this great timeline that he's going to explain to us. Welcome, Don. Thanks for joining us.
Bless you. Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here.
Don, would you like to give the listeners a little bit of your background? I know you've been an astrologer for a very long time, and you have a lot of credentials. And just introduce yourself a little bit and how you got interested in this broad overview of putting it all together.
I would be happy to. Thank you so much. I studied classics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. That was my degree, magna cum laude. And have really never let go. Graduated in 76. I've been an astrologer, professional astrologer, since 72, prior to my collegiate career. From that time, the 1st of December 1978, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, was the inauguration of my first radio show under the banner of Athena's Web. In March of 1983, that morphed into a newspaper column, which has appeared in a number of papers and currently is available online, although in the last couple of years, I've cut back from writing four times a month to the new and full moons. It's a full moon coming up. That's my deadline. In 2003, I built a Stonehenge, or Woodhenge, I call it, Phase 1. The Stonehenge that we're familiar with today, with all the stones, the blue stones from Wales, originally started out as 56 evenly spaced posts. And I created that on a winery in the Hamptons of Long Island in a story picked up by the New York Times. Although I did modify it a little bit, at each of the cardinal points I put a little gate. I had candles aligning the center, the gates, and out beyond, and they look like fairy paths working through this at night. It's incredible how much light a single candle can generate and the ambiance that it gives and goes along with it. So that was 2003. Then 2005, we moved. 2004 and 5, we were in Boulder, Colorado, where I got connected with Fisk Planetarium at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And that's where the beginnings, the PowerPoint presentation of what became the book, When the Dragon Wore the Crown, started. And I've been from coast to coast, Atlanta, St. Petersburg, Miami, Boston, New York, Phoenix, certainly San Francisco, all over the country doing this planetarium show. Last night I presented it to the Santa Cruz Astronomy Club. That's not
really
Astrology Club, that's the Astronomy Club. And they really enjoyed it. I'm not out there proselytizing or evangelical where astrology is concerned. I'm not trying to convert or say it's better or duel with the astronomers. What I've done is, in looking at the mythological code, I seem to have cracked a good portion of it so that it makes sense. Many of these ancient cultures were looking at the sky and trying to determine, to understand, the motions of heaven. And all time is basically the relationship between heaven and earth. The day is the rotation of the earth on its own axis. A month is the rotation of the moon around the earth. A year is the rotation of the earth around the sun. All of these units of time are born of the relationship between heaven and earth. And indeed, if we turn to Greek mythology, we find that Kronos, the father time, is the child of Uranus and Gaia, of the starry sky and Mother Earth. And that is the same formula, as you will, that we employ today and that we try to work with any units of time. Well, in looking back into antiquity, there was an hour hand, to give it a label, there was an hour hand that was used by many of the cultures of that period that we've largely dropped, and that represented the equinoxes. Where the equinox, and my work focuses on the vernal equinox, the springtime point, where the equinox falls in relationship to the sky, the constellation that it's currently moving through, ancient peoples thought apparently a great deal of, because down through time they reflected that image over and over again. And the main constellation that we work with in the book is the constellation of Draco. Basically, those civilizations that were extant approximately 5,000 years ago looked up into the skies and saw this great serpent spinning around and around and around, night after day, season after season, decade, century, and millennia after millennia. Draco is not a particularly bright constellation, but it is a very long constellation. It's a large constellation. And so for a period of approximately 5,000-6,000 years, it dominated the north celestial pole, the summit of heaven. It's, as if you will, in a misnomer, at the high ground of heaven. Any culture that was working with a calendar, and once we start looking at it in those terms, then things begin to make a lot more sense. Any culture that was working with a calendar had to integrate this information. And their myths, their rituals, began to go out on their New Year's Day. For some, that would be connected with the winter solstice. For many more, it was connected with the vernal equinox. They would go out on New Year's Day, and they would redetermine where the center of heaven, in fact, was, the north celestial pole. Now, we happen to be at a point in our time where the star Polaris, the last star in the tail of Ursa Minor, marks precisely, or nearly precisely, where the north celestial pole is. It's within about a half a degree at this moment and currently closing, getting tighter on that spot. So if you know how to find the north celestial pole in heaven, you're looking at the center of creation. Well, this is basically circa 2000 AD. If we go back to 2788 BC, there was another star that occupied that pole position at that time, and that was Thuban, or Alpha Draconis, the principal star in the constellation Draco. So at that time, there was also a star that indicated where the center, the summit of heaven was. And in my humble opinion, this was the dragon's gold, because all these cultures had to go out and redetermine, because of precession, which slightly moves the sky from year to year or decade to decade, the constellational pictures kept changing. And so they would have to go out with their little ceremony, and they would take their spear, their lance, their arrow, their dagger, or in the case of the Chinese, a common household pin, and they would stab the dragon. Well, what they're not really doing is taking a Komodo lizard and throwing it up into the sky and then running it through. They're determining where in heaven, or in the skies, if you prefer, this particular mark had moved to, because if you didn't determine the accurate astronomical center, then you didn't determine the accurate astronomical circle. The center controls the circle. If the center moves, the circle has to move. And so they were recalibrating every year, or every few years, where the new exact position was. So when the dragon wore the crown, takes this astronomical constellation and makes it the, if you will, king of heaven at that time. And as you go around from culture to culture, you find it pervasive. But that's not so unreasonable when one considers that for about 6,000 years, this one constellation was marking this one position in the heavens. So, in a nutshell, that's what the book looks at.
So, the time period that you're talking about, when the dragon wore the crown, would you outline that time period again and kind of go around the world about where, what civilizations were at different areas of the world?
Sure, and a very interesting one is if you go to the Thai dragons from Thailand, they're often indicated as a dragon wearing a crown, literally, when the dragon wore the crown. Well, what's interesting about that is that if you then go down to the southwestern U.S., you find Native American tribes that on their vases today will depict this great serpent winding its way around the top of their vases. In between the curves of the body of the serpent are placed rain clouds. At the mouth of the dragon is placed a lightning bolt, and on the head of the dragon is placed a crown. So
that's
there is
wild.
A very I handed the vase. I wound up purchasing it, but I handed the vase back to the woman that had made it, and you know, was sitting right there, a Native American individual. And I said, I pointed to it, and I says, "Where did you get this image from? Where did this come from?" And she looks up at me, and she says, "I don't know." So this is something that I think has been tradition, has passed down as an image, and they tradition helps to preserve the motif, but the astronomical accuracy of it has changed over the course of time. So with the Chinese, it's the imperial dragon. And the Chinese have two dragons, the plebeian or common dragon and the imperial dragon. Now, the plebeian dragon is the one that is in their zodiac. And in the Chinese zodiac, there are 11 figures, all of which we can identify, you know, rat, snake, boar, dog, etc., things that are common in life, with the exception of the dragon. And in the Chinese motif, there's that image. You move to India, and the dragon becomes one of the Nagas. The king snake, it's referred to as. And sometimes our dragon has wings, sometimes it doesn't, depending on the culture one's looking at. If you move to Greek civilization, then you've got Ledon, the dragon that circled the tree and protected the golden apples of the Hesperides. If you work with the Babylonian creation myth, which is really a misnomer, if our astronomy is telling us anything, it should be the Sumerian creation myth. The Sumerians were in Mesopotamia prior to the period of the Babylonians, in the same way that Greek culture, after the Romans defeated them, permeated Roman culture, and the Romans took on a lot of their Greek attributes. The Babylonian creation myth, it's more standard title, it's Tiamat and Marduk that wrestle back and forth. In Egyptian culture, it's Apophis, Apep, Apop, all different names for the dragon. All of them work. And what's really interesting is, though at least to me, is that if you move to the Americas, you begin to find some of the same themes. If you're listening to the name of the creature that's called the dragon, Tiamat, Apep, Ledon, the imperial dragon, etc., they sound different. But if you look at the image, if you're using your eyes rather than your ears to input this information, then the images become similar, and you realize that they're talking about one and the same. So that the Cherokee call it the Uktina. And this is this great serpent that it resides in the north. All these cultural themes come through, and since Draco is the constellational protector of the north celestial pole, that's the direction that indicates north, and one of the characteristic personalities of these dragons is it comes through in that way. The movie recently out on The Hobbit, Smaug that comes down out of the north. They incorporate all these characteristics in a contemporary motif. That's the way you make it real and you kind of hook people.
That, by the way, is one of the best dragons I've ever seen.
I have not yet seen part two.
Well, you have something to look forward to.
I've heard it's incredible.
Exceptionally good dragon.
That's the report I've gotten from others as well. So I'm very excited to see that. But it's the same themes. They're J.R.R. Tolkien or the movie creators, take your pick, are dipping their J.R. Rowling's are dipping their pen in the mythological pot and drawing from that. They all have really done their homework in incorporating these motifs into contemporary myth. Which is the way that we can see it. So, if you jump to the Americas, it's Oktina with the Cherokee. It's the Thunderbird with the Lakota, and one of the characteristics of the dragon is storms, lightning, rain, typhoons. In fact, that's one of the Greek names for the dragon, or the hurricane, which is the Central American name for the dragon, moving into Mayan culture. And if we move again down into the southwest with the crowned serpent that I've already referenced, that was a Vanyu to the tribes of the southwest. So in the southwest, in the Dakotas, Lakotas, in the east coast, you find Native American traditions honoring the same motif. And if you again, listen to the personality that is found about the dragon all around the world, it's found in these cultures as well. And indeed, emphasizing my point about if you look at the image as opposed to listen to the name, if you take a look at either Kukulkan, according to the Aztecs, or Quetzalcoatl, according to the Mayans, who is he? Well, they describe him as the feathered serpent, the flying snake, the dragon. It's the same thing over and over again. So what we begin to see, and this is all hypothesis, since I do this presentation for astronomers and those of a more scientific bent, I am often very careful to try to couch it in such a way that they can then see and say that, oh, okay, this fits, this works. So that I very rarely refer to it as, and this is what astrologers call it, as the vernal equinox, the springtime point move through these constellations. That's the age of Gemini, the age of Taurus, the age of Aries. Well, that's a no-no for the astronomers. So it's called, as the vernal equinox moves through the constellation Gemini, that's okay.
Right.
So you frame it in a context that they can hear it. And again, so far it works.
Yeah. So basically the concept is that if you have great ages where the vernal equinox is going through the different constellations, the bull, well, Draco, and then the bull, and the Gemini.
The vernal equinox is what's going on in the circle. Celestial pole is Draco. So there are two different, one's the center, the others represent the circle.
Okay, so the Draco is the center, and then the other ones are the circle. Would you go through the order that the constellations are in the book?
I would be happy to. Thank you for asking. I step back to when the vernal equinox was passing through the constellation Gemini. And that's the point I go back to, and then from that point I begin to work down towards the present. And the closer, of course, you get to the present, the more evidence or details or myth or history you begin to accrue. So you go back to the period of when the springtime point was in the constellation of the twins. Now, our earliest astronomical writers tell us that Gemini is associated with the element air. And if by that they meant creatures of the air, that would explain why in so much pottery, in so much imagery, in house walls and in other places where artistic motifs were left behind, there are images of birds and birds with eggs, birds carrying eggs, birds pregnant with eggs. And you see this theme over and over again. But in addition to that, one sees also twins and twins and twin-headed birds. And these motifs are the predominant artistic motif of their time. And if you bring into that, in addition to the eggs and the birds, that of the spiraling serpent, you really do have a culture and a tradition that was not only predominant, but which culminated about 5,000 B.C. Now, from approximately 6,200 B.C. down to 4,800 B.C. was the period of time during which, the sixth millennia, really, the period of time during which spring was moving through the constellation of the twins. So what these peoples and the motifs I'm relating to come from Central Europe, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, that portion of Europe at the time, then these images begin to make sense. They're simply, if they saw the twins and the stars of the twins as this dualistic concept, then they're simply reflecting their springtime, when what I believe is creation started again. The plants start to grow, the trees begin to flower, life is returning to the planet. So they saw this as creation, and they saw the stars as marking this period of creation for them. What else can we draw together? Now, as you begin to move into the archaeological evidence, which is what that represented, you start to listen, and all of a sudden you start hearing underneath a lot of these myths a period of time that was referenced as being born of the egg. And in my humble opinion, what they're talking about is anybody that was born, any culture that was born, anybody that lived during that period of time was born of the egg. And one of the common mythological motifs that comes through in culture after culture is the splitting of the egg in two. In Norse tradition, Odin took his sword and cut the egg in half. The upper half of the egg became the dome of the sky. The lower half of the egg became the earth itself. And we all live, or lived, in that cosmic creation at that time. Since I wrote the book, I've been studying Finnish myth. And the Finns, although they're next-door neighbors to the Scandinavians, apparently have a tradition that comes from the East and possibly the Mongol invasions. And you find it in Czechoslovakia and in Finland. And they talk about the splitting of the egg in the half, with the upper half becoming the dome of the sky and the lower half becoming the earth. If we go to Vishnu and the Vedas, Vishnu slept on the back of a serpent within the cosmic egg. And here you're beginning to see a little representation of center and circle, where the current north celestial pole was, the serpent that Vishnu slept on, Draco, and the cosmic egg, which is what appears on the circle at that time, where the vernal equinox is. If you move into China, you find Pan Ku, who was, right at the start of the myth, born of the egg. And Pan Ku often holds the symbol of the Tao, of duality, in his hands, in his arms. And that is the period that we're looking at. So you find it in Norse, you find it in Finnish, you find it in Hindu, which is India, you find it in China, and it just keeps going. In Greek mythology, the Dioscuri, the twins, known to the Greeks as Castor and Polydeuces, and to the Romans as Castor and Pollux, the twins wore the Pelos caps. And the Pelos caps were supposed to be the remains of the pieces of the egg from which they were born. So you just see it over and over and over again. And the Pelasgian myth, which was the people, some of the earliest peoples that lived in Greece, talk about Eurynome. And Eurynome giving birth to the egg on the cosmic waters. And in the north, she rolled her hands and created the serpent. And so you have the serpent and the egg. And these are among the old. Robert Graves admits that these are among the oldest Greek myths that they had. They're looking back as far in time as they thought they could at that point. Well, that's the vernal equinox passing through the constellation Gemini. From there, you move into the springtime point, moving into the constellation of the Bull. And the earliest evidence that we have for that is in Nabta Playa, southwestern Egypt. And apparently, they began to honor the bull, they would bury them and align their funeral caskets very evenly, beginnings of civilization and what we think of as urban living. And it passes into Egyptian culture with the Apis bull. And the Apis bull had the sun between the horns, and for 1,000 years, from approximately 4200 BC down to about 31,000-3,000 BC, depends on how you draw it, the vernal equinox, the springtime point, fell between the horns of the bull, just like so much Egyptian art shows us. They have the bull or the bovine with the solar disk in between the horns. When they looked up in the sky, that's what they saw for the time that they were living, particularly the Old Kingdom of Egypt. We move to the myth of Gilgamesh, and his buddy Enkidu tells Gilgamesh that if he is to slay the bull of heaven, the sword must be placed between the head and the shoulders of the bull. Well, the V in the head of the bull is the Hyades. The Pleiades are the shoulder of the bull. And the vernal equinox passed between the Hyades and the Pleiades from approximately 2600 down to about 2400 BC. So they're watching the skies, and they're simply watching spring as it moves from constellation to constellation. The Minoans are the end of the bovine imagery. They continue to honor that. They're focused on the back of the bull. The vernal equinox has moved from between the horns to between the head and the shoulder, to the back of the bull. It's a natural progression. And yet, this is what each of these cultures are honoring in their appropriate astronomical time. They all knew about this, and they were passing this information from one to the other. From there, you move down into the realm of Aries, the ram, and this goes back to, in Hebrew tradition, to Abraham, who's about to sacrifice his son because God tells him to, and his hand is stayed by the angel, and there in the bushes a ram is provided. So the cut is now to be made on the ram instead of the son. We find a very similar myth in Greek tradition of Phrixus and Helle, where the two children, Phrixus and Helle, are about to be sacrificed, and a ram with a golden fleece comes and flies in. They get on his back, and they fly off through the sky. It's not too difficult. Every time you get, well, I won't say every time, but many times when you get people seeing things flying through the sky, they say, oh, this must be an alien craft. Well, it's very easy to imagine the constellations flying through the sky. That's what they do. You don't need an alien craft to interpret this one. And then later, Jason and the Argonauts gathers together the greatest heroes of Greece, and they go off on a quest for the Golden Fleece. So if you go back to Gemini, and I need to let you ask another question here, you go back to a tradition that searched for the cosmic egg, and that is a tradition that is preserved in the Easter egg hunts that we have today. That is our springtime ritual. If we go back to the period during which spring was moving through the bull, there was the quest for the Apis bull. If you move down to the period of the ram and Aries, there is the search for the golden fleece. So the hunt for the Easter egg, the hunt for the Apis bull, the hunt or the quest for the golden fleece, they're all seeking to locate where the new springtime point is going to be in heaven, and it keeps changing from year to year.
Well, that's very interesting. It really is.
Now, those are Mediterranean cultures. That was primarily rooted into the Mediterranean, which is our own tradition. You find evidence of that in other traditions as well. And again, no, not all the zodiacs match. The Hindu zodiac doesn't exactly match the Chinese zodiac. Certainly the Mayan zodiac is totally out there as far as imagery is concerned. But around this central image, something that you used the same constellation for approximately a period of 6,000 years, that gives the image time to really permeate from culture to culture. And who's using the stars? Well, your mariners and your travelers who are trying to determine which way to go. Your architects, the people that are organizing civilization and society. This is hugely important information for them to ascertain and to pass on in very practical terms. They had phenomenal uses for people that knew how to work with it. And for their people that were spreading to the edge of their cultures, their traders, that would carry pots or motifs or whatever they would have, and the people they'd bump into and they'd say, who's that? Then you tell them who it is and you pass on what you know. Well, eventually, this information, in my humble opinion, gets spread around the world. And we do find evidence of it around the world, even down to the rainbow serpent in Australia. In Australia.
So tell me more about the rainbow serpent.
Well, I'm glad you asked. It is a name that is, in fact, used on three different continents for obviously a serpent, the rainbow serpent. We're most familiar with it in the Australian Aborigines time, but it's also to be found as a, and I'd have to look, Don Hoedo, and I may be butchering that, an African tradition, and the Native Americans of North America called it the rainbow serpent. So there's the same name in Australia, Africa, North America that seems to be tying this together. And I do believe that going back prior to, 6,000 B.C. and earlier, I do believe there was a worldwide consciousness that was beginning to come together, that was beginning to talk to each other, that was developing something of a common language. Not in the way that we think of Sanskrit or Greek or English, but rather a symbolic language where they were looking, they all shared the same sky. And that is what's common, no matter where you go, whether you're out in the middle of a desert or you're out in the middle of the Mediterranean or the Atlantic or the Pacific, the sky and the stars are what you use because nothing else is consistent. It's again, hugely important. Our academians are only just now looking at the Mayan culture, and how difficult is it to get into a boat and follow the coastline around the Gulf of Mexico until you get to Florida, and you have cultural similarities going on between Florida and Central America. And that's not that big a deal. Why do we so isolate these cultures from one another? This is something in the book. If one looks at the table of contents, I jump around from culture to culture because here's this piece and then here's how it relates to that one. What most mythology books will do is they will study Finnish culture, and that's the chapter. Then they study Roman culture, and that's the chapter. Well, they were interrelated, in my humble opinion, that they fed one into another, and they were telling very similar themes.
And I did want to mention at this point that the book is really a wonderful, wonderfully illustrated and put together. It's a very high quality book with just great photographs and images and symbols and artwork.
It's driven by the images. And people always used to tell me, they still tell me, you know, you write your text and then you put your images in. No. I take the images and then write the text around it.
Yeah. Well, it's just gorgeous. It really is.
Thank you so much.
I have a question. This doesn't relate. I know we're still going through the what were we up to in terms of the last age we went through? What was it?
Well, we stand now at the edge of that, and the book does very little bit, but the book basically doesn't get into that, because the last age is the age when the vernal equinox is moving through the constellation of the fish, Pisces.
Uh-huh.
And that period of time represents Christian culture.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a real dichotomy between the classical tradition and the Christian tradition. For one thing, as these astronomical vantage points begin to come in, this is culture, wisdom, intelligentsia, et cetera, et cetera, the Christians are not really interested in having pagan gods, which is how they saw the planetary beings and stars, in taking over. And so astronomy really takes a nosedive as Christianity begins to come in because of this, if you want, ethnic bias. And it's not really until the Crusades, when the Christians are being gathered in Europe and go off to the Levant, to Palestine and Jerusalem, and try to reclaim the Holy Land for Christianity, that astronomy re-enters Europe and begins to take off again. It's been long enough that they've forgotten some of the what they considered to be less desirable characteristics of the pagan gods. It's been long enough that's happened at that time. So I do just barely touch upon the early influences, and the early Christians were in fact aware of this celestial motif. The whole idea of what these different peoples are doing is they believed that divinity was in the skies, was in the stars, was in the heavens. And it was their job, especially back during Gemini, when you're talking about identical twins, it was their job to be a reflection of heaven on earth. And that's one of the reasons why, as we go around to many of the monuments around the globe, for instance, the three stars or the three pyramids in the plain of Giza that seem to reflect Orion's belt. And as you go to Arthurian England, they were cultivating the landscape to make it reflect heaven's will. And as time moved on, they continued to try to reflect heaven's will. Nebuchadnezzar, in 600 B.C., begins the new year. Again, we come back to this new year theme being associated with the dragon over and over again in various cultures. Because, again, they're trying to figure out their new calendar. So the first thing you got to do is you got to find the center, and then you deal with your circle, and then you start putting in your religious holidays, etc. So the early Christians were aware of the heavenly picture changing from that out of the ram into that of the fish, and that is why the fish becomes a symbolic motif representing this period of time. And they would draw, supposedly, the fish, you know, the little fish we see in all the bumpers now of cars, telling people I'm a Christian. But if you go into the New Testament, which is the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, is really a product of the vernal equinox moving through the constellation of the ram. The New Testament, the Christian Bible, is a product of the vernal equinox moving into the constellation Pisces. So that walking on water, Pisces is a water sign, walking on water, changing water into wine, of catching the fish and pulling out the shekel tax and paying the half shekel tax for, I believe it was Peter and for Jesus, for feeding the multitudes with two fish.
Right.
All of these themes that are being woven into the New Testament, they recognized that it was a new cosmic vibration, if you will, a new heavenly mandate, is another way to put it, and that there was a new way of being, whereas the Aries had represented the classical tradition, i.e. your princes and your princesses and the king and the queen and nobility and things like that. As you shift into Pisces, Pisces is a constellation or a sign thought of nowadays, that represents the poor, those that don't have money, the beggar, the thief. And so when the Roman magistrate goes to the Christian minister and says, show me your riches, he brings him to where the populace is, and he waves his hand out over the people, and he said, these are our riches. The first four disciples are fishermen. That's
right.
Not unintentional. I will make you fishers of men. Jesus is very aware of the new celestial mandate. He's teaching the disciples about this as he moves through. So, they were aware, but one of the characteristics of Pisces is that it represents the sea, the cosmic sea, the Neptune Sea, which is representative of the subconscious and all of the products of the subconscious. Well, subconscious means below the level of awareness, something you don't know or you forget. And as we move into the period of Christianity, the last 2,000 years, we lose this divine association, the relationship of heaven to earth, and it's forgotten. So the connection to the astronomical side of it is passed over and becomes criminal, actually, as time goes on. Well, we now stand at the other end of that age, and there is a new vibration. One of the easiest ways for your listeners to understand it would be through electricity. And anything that we plug in or power up, or I'm talking to you on the telephone, or the clock is there on the wall, or computers or cell phones, this is all the incoming vibration that is getting stronger and more potent as we go. In the 70s, you could buy a wristwatch that would add, subtract, multiply, and divide. And that was the hottest thing since sliced bread.
Right.
And it was like $300. Well, look at what $300 will buy you now. I mean, you got Google Earth. You can
Google
do telephone calls. It's incredible. And the price, you get more and more technology for less and less cost. This is Aquarius coming in. So we stand at the juncture of a new point, but because Pisces is ending, or specifically has ended, but it's not something that all takes place in a day, and Aquarius is coming in, there's these two huge cultural currents that are running into each other, and unfortunately in the Crimea and out in China and Japan, and even what's going on in this country, although it hasn't totally bubbled to the surface yet here, we're seeing a period of huge transition and change. And this is what you asked about Pisces. This is what Jesus called, his disciples say, tell us of the end of the world. And he responds, they don't understand it quite right. He responds by saying, all this is the beginnings of the labor pains, indicating that it's not the end of the world, but the birth of something new.
Right.
And labor pains are not fun. It's not going to be an easy transition, is the translation. And we stand at that time now, and the greater intensity and the power of the storms that we're seeing are a part of this shift in consciousness that we're all being exposed to, and that hopefully we get our houses in order, and we treat each other like human beings with respect and love, and that we begin to stand once again in balance with the earth, which we're totally not doing. The fracking is taking over. And that's not going to be advantageous for our own health and well-being, never mind those of our children and our children's children. So anyway, that's the last age. We are actually at the transition point, and that's one of the reasons you and I are talking. This information is beginning to be disseminated amongst the people. And while we wave the flag of the people, by the people, for the people, it's been a long time since the people have really done anything on a political level that has been beneficial for either the country or the planet.
We've got things like the Internet that will help the people communicate and spread ideas without needing to rely on things like mainstream media, which are politically controlled.
Exactly, and that's the electronic component I talked about.
It is.
That's
yeah.
what's coming in and getting stronger. Yes, our ability to communicate with each other is, you know, in the African Spring in Cairo,
mm-hmm.
Right. You know, women and all these diverse groups of people got on their cell phones and tweeted and did everything, and they all came out together.
Mm-hmm.
That is a symbol of where we're headed. Unfortunately,
well, it allows people to plan for things. You know that. I mean, there's a platform there for planning. I wanted to go back to this idea of the intermittent changing cosmic vibration, which I guess is always preceded by labor pains, like you described. What is the how many years pass before the next cosmic vibration comes in? What is the period of that?
Well, we haven't fully embraced this one yet. We are in the process only at the very beginning of it. However common,
okay.
I answer your question. Each of the ages, they have a great year, which is one cycle through the whole process, is a little less than 26,000 years. So if
okay.
there are 12 signs or constellations to the zodiac, you divide 12 into 26,000, and you get a little over 2,000 years per age.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it boils down, given the current industry standard, to 2,152 years each.
Okay.
So we're many centuries from the next major transition.
Makes you wonder what will be coming forth if we're going to get a lot more electronics and biophysics and all sorts of interesting
it's
things.
It's a wonderful time to be alive. And
yeah,
if I may, what the Book of Revelation is
mm-hmm.
it is a book written in the first century A.D. at the very start of the age of Pisces. And they're looking ahead and trying to make predictions of what the age of Pisces will bring. And they do talk in chapters 21 and 22 of once they're through Pisces and entering into Aquarius. And that apparently will be a time, according to Revelation, where divinity and the people on the planet are getting along together again. The God's name will be God is with them. And so we're tuning back in. We're trying to understand and work with the energies around us rather than being combative and isolationistic and building forts everywhere and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
That's what it boils down to, fighting.
Yeah.
Right. So we stand at a wonderfully exciting time. There's a lot happening out there. Ooh, look, a ship in the air.
Yeah, right.
But it's also a somewhat frightening time. It's flushing
mm-hmm.
people's latent abilities, but it's also flushing, if they don't have a platform to work with, it's flushing fears.
Mm-hmm.
Because what do you do if you've never had to deal with this before? People tend to fear the unknown rather than embrace it.
Right. That's true. I've interviewed other authors who talked about every 28,000, 29,000 years.
26,000, a little under that.
Right, that there is a alignment with the galactic center, you know, of the Earth and the Sun, the Earth, and the galactic center align, and then there's a new vibration or energy that comes forth. And so it may correspond that it's the galactic center has something to do with this periodic cosmic vibration. What do you think of that? Is there
it does, and in my humble opinion, I'm very much the maverick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm an astrologer. That makes me sort of out there anyway. And then I'm sort of a step beyond a bunch of the astrologers. I have my own opinions.
Mm-hmm.
And vis-a-vis the one that you've just mentioned, in my humble opinion, when the Mayan calendar came to a close in the winter solstice of 2012, people were looking around for an astronomical answer as to
mm-hmm.
why the calendar was coming to a conclusion at that time, and what they came up with was the galactic center and the alignment of the winter solstice in particular with the galactic center. I've been talking about the equinox, but they were going to the other quarter points, the solstice, and
right.
and they said, ooh, this is it. This is the trigger. This is what the Mayans are on about. That's not my opinion. For one thing, if you take an astronomical program and look at what is commonly considered to be the galactic center, we're currently about 2.5 degrees out of that. Now, you're talking with a 360-degree circle, and by precession, 2.5 degrees, well, 1 degree is approximately 72 years, 2 degrees is 144 years, so 2.5 degrees is, 160, 180 years, somewhere in there. Somebody do the math. And according to that, we are 180 years or so from the alignment that they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in 2005, I had to rewrite my whole program because the astronomy program that had given me the vernal equinox pictures went from version 1 to version 4, theoretically an improved version, and it gave me slightly different dates on a number of these alignments to these stars. I had to recalculate everything. And, you know, some of them were only a year or two off. Some of them were 10 years off. They were close. But you've got people that are saying it's 180 years, and I've had to fine-tune this for a year, year and a half, 2 years, and I just don't think so. Now, I do have an answer as to what was going on for the Mayan calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And in the calendar year that the winter solstice of 2012, so that means, you know, a couple of weeks, December, and then the rest of the following year is that cycle that they're dealing with, about 7.5 weeks after the winter solstice of 2012, the 11th of February 2013 to be precise, Omega Piscium aligned with the celestial meridian of heaven. In astronomical terms, that's right ascension midheaven. 0 hours, 0 minutes, and 0 seconds of the alignment. And that's sort of where the tumblers all kick over and start again. And that point aligned with Omega Piscium again. Well, I believe that Revelation is showing us there's only three places in the Bible that they talk about the Alpha and the Omega.
Right.
And all three of those are in the book of Revelation.
Right.
The first star that the vernal equinox, the springtime point, aligned with in the constellation Pisces was Alpha Piscium. The star that has just aligned with the vernal equinox, the springtime point, 0 hours, 0 minutes, 0 seconds, is Omega Piscium.
Mm-hmm.
I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first
right.
and the last. The beginning and the end. They are
mm-hmm.
defining for us the age of Pisces.
Age of Pisces, right. Yeah.
So for years, for literally decades now, I've been saying when Omega is triggered, and I've given the date, you just heard it,
mm-hmm.
February 11th, 2013, 7.5 weeks after the winter solstice of 2012,
mm-hmm.
when that's aligned, that will be the end of the age of Pisces. And I've been
right.
waiting and waiting and waiting to see what it would bring. Guess what happened on the 11th of February, 2013?
I don't remember.
The Pope said he quit.
Really?
On that
wow.
day.
Oh, my goodness.
And I've gone through the seven seals, and I've astronomically
uh-huh.
dated all of them, and it's simply a point in history. And then I went back and took a look at what was historically going on at each of those dates,
mm.
and they're huge events in Roman and Christian history. And
that's
the eighth
wild.
Seal, the one that finishes it, well, this is what they were doing. They were looking at the vernal equinox. For 6,000
mm.
years, they had deemed it to be important. Here comes
mm.
the next chapter. And so all they got to do is line it up with the stars, and it works the same way astrology does.
Mm-hmm.
As a planet
right.
aligns with a position in your chart, that's when these themes are triggered. Well, now you're just working
mm-hmm.
with the next step beyond planets. You're working with the stars. But it yields all this information, so I cranked all that out. None of that is in the book because
mm-hmm.
I don't want to get in. The next book is going to handle all that, and I've written
right.
over 200
yeah.
pages. But I try to break it down and have it astronomically make sense. and to mm-hmm. look at the history of what was going on. So anyway,
so you would say now we really are in the age of Aquarius.
We are currently in the age of Aquarius. It began
right.
as far back as the Industrial Revolution, and right mm-hmm. with that time you had the American Revolution and then the French Revolution, and 100
right.
years later you had the Russian Revolution. That is all Aquarius incoming.
Mm-hmm.
But an age, it begins to get light before the sun actually crosses the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the energy, the vibration of Aquarius beginning to spill over, getting stronger and stronger. You know, it wasn't until the 20s that we got the women's vote, for crying out loud.
Right.
But
yeah,
not
sure.
that long ago.
No,
we're still
not
working on it.
Yeah, a lot of revolutions.
And women around the world, I mean, you know, with some of the horrors that are going on with what they can and can't do,
mm-hmm.
we're still seeing it happen. Pisces, when an age ends and a new age begins, again, the characteristics, the traditions of an old period continue for a while.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
that's what
yeah.
people for generations have been taught to do.
Mm-hmm.
It's only those that are really attuned to what's incoming and know what it's about that can really embrace better transition and change. And we're seeing it all around
yeah.
us now.
But it's all good news. I mean, it's all good news what's coming.
The prophecies that are being told about Revelation, once we get through these labor pain stages, are good news. For the first time in a long time, humanity is going to finally get along with itself, among other things.
Well, Don, we're at the end of our hour. Would you quickly give some contact information for the audience?
What, for you or for me?
No, for you.
Thank you so much. Sure. The website, there's a host of activity on it. Go to the archives, give it a chance to load. There's 13 years worth of information there. Is www.athenasweb, that's the goddess, athenasweb, all one word, .com. The Gmail is Athena. The email is athenasweb@gmail.com. And if you go there, I'm sure you can dig up a phone number too.
Well, thanks, Don. We've been interviewing Don Sereau on When the Dragon Wore the Crown, and we will anticipate his next book, which will cover the Age of Pisces and the upcoming or the current Age of Aquarius, and hopefully have him back on. Thanks a lot for joining us, Don. It's been fascinating.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Please join us next week.